Greetings, and welcome to A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, my guest is James Corbett, creator of The Corbett Report. The Corbett Report is an independent, listener-supported alternative news source. It operates on the principle of open-source intelligence and provides podcasts, interviews, articles, and videos about breaking news and important issues, from 911 truth and false flag terror to the Big Brother police state, eugenics, geopolitics, the central banking fraud, and more. James has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Since then, he has written, recorded, and edited over 1,000 hours of audio and video media for the website, including a weekly podcast, a weekly radio program, and several regular online video series. He works as a film producer for GRTV, the video production arm of the Center for Research on Globalization, a partner video producer for BoilingFrogsPost.com, the website of noted FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds, and an editorial writer for TheInternationalForecaster.com, the weekly e-newsletter created by the recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. So you can find out more on his website at www.CorbettReport.com. So let's welcome James to the show now. Hi, James. How are you?
Well, I'm doing just great, and that was a very lengthy introduction, so I thank you for soldiering through that.
Yes, well, I know that you're used to doing this yourself, so sometimes I my tongue gets tied when, but it's okay, because even pretzels can be consumed, so... I really love your work, and there's a lot that I don't know about, and I hope that we can get into some of that because we've got only an hour. But one of the sites that you host, I noticed that there was a prediction, the International Forecast, there was a prelude by Bob Rainier before some of your articles about the Year of the Snake. And there's a lot of talk about economic collapses, what the bankers are doing, that there's an intentional plan collapse or currency wars. We know that everything is manipulated. From your viewpoint, having been exposed to so many different sources, what do you feel is actually going on and that the public will need to become aware about?
Well, I think the economic collapse is probably one obvious place to start. And unfortunately, it's the kind of thing that there is, I think, no way of accurately predicting exactly when it will occur in the sense that people are expecting it to occur. If it ever does occur in that straightforward sense, it might just be the long, slow economic decline that unfortunately will have pretty much the same effect. So, but I think it's pretty much inevitable the way they're just treating the money supply and just basically printing money off into infinity at the moment. And that's, of course, devaluing the money. And there's going to be a point of reckoning on all of this, especially with the debt ceiling talks that are still going on in Washington and all of this craziness at the political level. I think we're going to see some kickback on that in the economy sometime over the course of the coming years, but I can't predict if that's going to be this year or next or the one after that, because they've done an excellent job of stringing out this economic wonderland for this long. But as I say, it is inevitable. It's a mathematical certainty that it's going to collapse at a certain point. And there are some interesting signs that there may be something happening this year. And one of the things that I'm looking ahead to is next month, there's going to be a BRICS summit in Durban, South Africa. BRICS being the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, who have formed a type of developing country union, I suppose, as it were, to sort of pool their resources. And they are thinking of starting a new development bank as a type of bulwark against the IMF World Bank. So that's an interesting development, and we'll have to see what comes of that, whether something serious will come of it or if it will just basically be more noise in the background. But again, it's those types of left field curveballs that I think can actually affect some sort of change and perhaps bring about some toppling of the dominoes. So that's one of the things I certainly have my eyes on in the coming year.
Now, what about the idea that so there are competing factions for the world's resources and that have different ideologies, obviously, but it seems like the one that we're most preoccupied with is the one that is the most extreme, the one that people have referred to as the New World Order, and now it's turning into something else. It seems that no sooner do people start to hear the buzzwords than it's changed into something rather melodic and harmonic, which is quite appealing for us to fall into. This ties into the idea that there are false flag events that are occurring, and that even the financial events like the Great Depression and the other currency problems that we've had are manufactured as pump-and-dump operations.
Agreed completely. I think that this is very much planned. And I also think that although there may be different factions within the coming New World Order government system that they want to bring in, I think that ultimately they share the same ideology. They might have different routes for arriving there, but I think that all of the main players on the chessboard right now have the same ideas in mind. They just are taking different routes to get there. And the extent to which they're actually competing against each other, some of that I think is smoke and mirrors, and some of that is cooperation behind the scenes. So I think we have to be wary of that. But I agree completely. It is interesting how they bring out some of these phrases and ideas that at first seem ominous, and it makes it sound like, how can anyone go along with this? But soon enough, people are not only accepting it, but actually embracing it. It sounds so great. It sounds so melodic. It sounds so harmonic. If we can just cloak the depopulation of the human species in nice woolly rhetoric about sustainability, then it sounds like a good thing. And how could you be against it? And they have a very good understanding, I think, of human psychology and how it works and how they can introduce some of these concepts so that people actually start desiring their own enslavement and ultimately their own death.
Oh, right, right. And you make a reference to in support of the work of John Taylor Gatto and also Richard Grove at TragedyAndHope.com. That's Tragedy and Hope. I'm not drunk. I don't drink. I just sometimes slur my words. But I know that that's one of the avenues that's getting out a volume of information that helps educate people so that we can get up to speed. It seems like there is a massive, not only brainwashing and mind control going on all over the globe, especially in the United States, but also, I forgot what I was going to say. See, it's happening to me now.
But I hear your train of thought, and I think that you're exactly right. You're touching on one of the key subjects, which is education and the greater idea of about how we learn. Because we often tend to frame education in talking about children, but I think we're all engaged in educating ourselves about what's going on. So I think we can all relate to it. And absolutely on the note of John Taylor Gatto and TragedyAndHope.com, for people out there who don't know about Mr. Gatto, basically he was a New York State Teacher of the Year back in the 1990s, and he resigned on the editorial pages of the New York Times in a pretty garish way. He resigned by basically calling out the school system for the indoctrination system that it is. And since then, he's gone on to write books about the myth of a college education and these types of subjects. And recently, Tragedy and Hope put together a 5-hour interview with John Taylor Gatto called The Ultimate History Lesson. Absolutely fascinating stuff. Goes into some of the real history behind the public schooling system as we know it today and how that actually came into place and why it came into place, more importantly, because so much of our economy as we've known it has been predicated on basically manufacturing a nice set of workers every year that graduate from the high schools and or colleges ready to join the workforce and basically have already been indoctrinated with thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of sitting in a classroom listening to an authority figure tell them how the world works and what it is, and having their days segmented up into little time sections divided by bells, and being trained to basically act like trained puppies. And unfortunately, it's worked extremely well. But there are, I think, more and more people shaking out of that indoctrination matrix each and every day through the marvels of things like the internet, by which we are communicating with each other right now, halfway around the world and in completely different time zones. So it is an amazing world we're living in, and I think that there are a lot of hopeful signs, but we also have to be, we have to acknowledge that there are some problems as well that we have to deal with as a society.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. And I think as people move out of that denial, it may take some shocks to do that. But we've stuffed this information down for lifetimes, and it seems like it's time for us to kind of snap out of our zombie state. Now, you're in Japan, and Japan was recently hit with the tsunami with the Fukushima event. How is that faring over there, just since I have you there at the site, more or less?
Well, unfortunately, not so well. And for people who are interested in Fukushima, I'm keeping a website, FukushimaUpdate.com, where I'm trying to keep up to date. I don't update it every day anymore, but I do try to put up the latest stories. And unfortunately, one of the latest stories we have is that two more youths in Fukushima have been diagnosed with thyroid cancer. And so now we're starting to see some of at least what could be the possible effects of Fukushima. Of course, the government is denying that this has anything to do with Fukushima, but thyroid cancer is one of the earliest signs of the radiation poisoning that we would expect. And of course, that is exactly what happened in the Chernobyl area following the Chernobyl disaster in 1986. One of the first signs was thyroid cancer in young people, because of course, that's the people who are most vulnerable to this. And now we're seeing it, lo and behold, in Fukushima, exactly as predicted. So this is a worrying development, and unfortunately not something that wasn't expected. And neither is the government denial about what's going on there unexpected. But again, that just fits into a pattern of cover-up that we've seen basically since the actual onset of the disaster itself, basically since day one. And as we now know, of course, they knew within days of the disaster itself, they had it confirmed and knew without a doubt that there had been complete meltdowns in three of the reactors. But they didn't bother revealing that to the rest of the world for a few months, obviously, in order to spare the Japanese from panic or whatever ridiculous ideas they had as to why they were doing it. But it has been a disaster in every possible way. And unfortunately, it's just another sign of the fact that governments, despite all their flowery rhetoric and platitudes, are not really in the end there to help. They are more often than not just there to, at the very least, cover for their own existence and try to make themselves more grandiose with each disaster.
Right. No kidding. No kidding. And doesn't it seem that there's a sickness that's going on within government? The more secretive it gets and the bigger it gets, the more secretive and powerful and the more forces are playing against each other and people don't even really know. There's literally no transparency. I mean, we're basically fed BS morning to night on the mainstream media, and there's literally no transparency. There's just bread and circuses, which kind of reminds you of the Roman days. And does it look like this is a repetition of cycles in the past where we're reaching the collapse of an empire or many empires?
Well, I think that is an apt analogy in a lot of ways. And you also talk about the spreading of secrecy through the system as a type of sickness. And I think that's a good analogy. I think it really is a type of cancer that starts out very small and seems quite manageable, but very quickly starts to overtake the entire system itself. And at the very least, I think we can locate the starting date for that sickness in the American system in 1948, I want to say, when the passage of the National Security Act, which basically brought the CIA into existence out of the ashes of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the wartime intelligence agency, and started to create the infrastructure for the national security state and all of the things that are now done in the name of security and secrecy. Oh, we have to be secret because we're spying on the enemies, et cetera, et cetera. And that's always the excuse that's used to bring all of these apparatus into place. And unfortunately, as my listeners know, and I'm sure many of your listeners are aware, that is just the start of a slippery slope by which there's the erection really of a secret government, a government behind the scenes that becomes institutionalized even once you start bringing it into existence with the National Security Act and other things like that, whereas it had been more of an informal alliance of people who had political power and access to the printing presses at the central bank, etc. Now it's institutionalized in the structure of the government itself, and you have this agency like the CIA and all of the other security agencies, quote-unquote, that can go around basically doing what they want with impunity all the way around the world and not really being called out on it and not really having to be accountable for it. And that's the perfect place for people who want to basically enact their own agenda to nest themselves within that government system. And unfortunately, as we've seen over the past 5 or 6 or 7 decades now, it's worked only too well. And now we've arrived at this point where, as you say, almost everything is done in complete secrecy. And you have the president of the U.S., for example, signing bills into law saying or proclaiming that he can arrest citizens using the military, even American citizens, anywhere in the world, even on U.S. soil at any time without ever having to bring them to trial. And all of these other just ridiculous police state measures that one wants to say have never been encoded in law before. They've certainly been practiced by other states, but most states in history haven't been brazen enough to actually put this down on paper in writing. And we're at this stage where most Americans, unfortunately, seem to be completely sleepwalking through this and don't quite understand the significance. So I think really the defining task for a lot of people out there is to get people to at least acknowledge what's happening and to really make them make that choice that we are all making right now, to either go along with the system to get along or to actually stand up and do something about it. And it's always my contention that there are things that we as individuals can do about this, and we have to be raising awareness of those types of things in order to, you know, head this off at the pass.
Absolutely. It's interesting when you mentioned 1948 that isn't it kind of coincidental that in 1947 there was a mysterious Roswell event, and it makes you wonder if 1948 wasn't in a kind of part of the reaction to the whatever it was that happened during those couple of years in order to keep things secret.
Well, I would like to say those types of things are related, and that could be for a number of different reasons. It could, of course, even be that that type of information is planted as a type of red herring by the intelligence agencies. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways that that can work, but absolutely.
That's,
I think,
right.
When we start looking at highly secretive and repressed pieces of history like that, there's a lot of different ways that can actually directly relate to the security state that's been erected around it. And of course, that's the type of thing that fascinates a lot of people and can motivate them to actually start looking into this. So to that extent, I suppose it might even be a healthy thing. But again, I think we have to question why this secrecy exists and why basically citizens are being treated as children who can't possibly know the truth. Oh, we can't tell you everything. That would just be too much for you. And I think we have to stand up against that mentality and demand to know what it is the government knows about all sorts of events like that and others.
Absolutely. It's a little unfortunate that most people are now stuck between 2 and 3 jobs and going from various fast food restaurants to Walmart, no plug intended, buying their groceries and their shopping stuff. We become so compressed that it's rather convenient that nobody has time to things.
Isn't it exactly the case? Yeah. And that's, I think, really the key to the whole economic system and why I spend so much time taking a look at what's happening economically, because that's something that I think people don't give enough credit to, which is we tend to assume that the way that our lives function at the moment is the way the world is and the way it's supposed to be and the way it always has been. That's kind of our weakness as mere mortals. We are not really able to appreciate just how much of the context that we're living in is arbitrary and has been created around us. So that when we are placed into this economy where it's just how it is. You just have to have two parents working full-time jobs to scrape by enough to hopefully make ends meet, and that's just the way it is. And even a generation ago, that wasn't the way it was, but we've come to accept that. So now we accept, you have to buy your cheap slave-made Chinese goods at Walmart and shut up and enjoy it, and this is the way life is. And unfortunately, we can get caught up in believing that hype and believing that this really is the way that the world is supposed to look. And I think it really helps us to try to step outside of that as much as possible and to really question all of the things that we're being placed into, all of these systems and structures of control that we're placed into on a daily basis.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It is a matrix of control. David Icke expresses it pretty well and a few other people, but... One of the things that you mentioned brought up the idea about the Fukushima event there, that sometimes it's hard to tell what's going on because we don't know what's being brought about through technology like HARP, the weather wars, chemtrails, and GMO, and the rest of it. We just don't know what's causing what anymore. And weather events now, I tend to question whether an event that's global is a real event or if it's Memorex. So, at least there's some questioning there, but most people can look up into the skies and see chemtrails and they don't see anything but a nice blue clear sky.
And you're not exaggerating when you say that, because I myself have been here in Japan. I used to be teaching full time at elementary and junior high schools here in Japan. And one morning I was out watching the children preparing for a sports day. And I was just looking up at this clear blue sky. And over the course of an hour, I watched it completely ridden over by the clouds that had been left behind by these planes going overhead. And I looked up and I was watching this process taking place. And by the end of it, it was just a murky, soupy, gray mess up there. I don't even want to call it clouds because it really isn't, I think, the same structure. And I was looking up at this and literally pointing it out to one of the other teachers and saying, those aren't clouds. And he didn't even understand what I was saying. I mean, part of it might have been the language barrier, but honestly, I think he just couldn't get the concept that, yes, it's a cloudy day. So it is bizarre to see that there are certain people who just can't bring themselves to see what's happening right, literally right over their heads. And that, yeah, I think, is one of the most worrying things, because that shows to me that things like what George Orwell was writing about back in 1948 when he wrote 1984 is true. It's literally true that people can literally actually stop themselves from seeing what is actually in front of their eyes with this process of doublethink, and can actually, I guess, just stop believing their own lying eyes as long as the government tells them that there's nothing to see. And that is an extremely worrying phenomenon, because it really makes you wonder how you can break through that barrier of conditioning with people. Because if they are so conditioned they can't see what's literally happening in front of their eyes, how are you ever going to reach them with any type of reasoned argument?
Yeah, absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. It's rather uncomfortable to be able to see some things that are going on in the world and not be able to talk about them, because people are either incredulous or they will have a negative reaction and they'll take it out on you because you're pointing it out.
Yeah, the bearer of bad news, unfortunately, bears the brunt of the problem. And again, this is something that we can see in all sorts of different ways. I would refer people to the excellent 1980s movie They Live, which showed that process in quite an entertaining fashion at any rate. And of course, the idea is that you can put on these special glasses and you can see all of the conditioning and programming and everything that's happening underneath the surface that most people can't see. And it comes to a certain point where this character who has these special glasses is trying to get one of the other characters to put the glasses on so he can see what's actually happening, and this alien takeover that's actually happening, and so he's literally fights the other person to try to put the glasses on, and they get into a fist fight over it. And I think it's a great metaphor for what happens to a lot of people who are concerned about what's happening and are trying to get people to at least question what's happening, and people will resist, and sometimes physically will fight with every last breath they have to keep themselves in that matrix, because it is always the path of least resistance to simply go along with what we're being told, not to question authority, just put your head down and hope that whatever happens, you'll be able to keep your beer and your cheeseburgers and your football games, and you can go back to sleep. And that's, I think, what a certain segment of this the population actually desires. They just want that. They don't want to put up any type of fight, and they're content to live in that type of box. And unfortunately, I think people can get frustrated trying to reach people from within that box when they're happy to be there. I think really this is the type of thing that people have to make the choice for themselves. So what I tend to do at the Corbett Report is to lay out the information as best I can and show the sources that I use to come to that, the conclusions that I come to, and tell people, well, it's up to you now. And I'm not sitting here begging anyone, oh, please believe me on this or that. I'm just simply putting forward the truth as I see it, and people can do with it as they will.
Right. I really like your reporting. And speaking of sources, you work indirectly or directly with the FBI whistleblower, Sybil Edmonds. I'm just now starting to do some research on her, thanks to you. And maybe you can share a little bit about Sybil and what your relationship is with her, what she's doing, and some of the information that's come through Sybil.
Well, Sybil Edmonds was hired by the FBI shortly after 9/11. In the wake of 9/11, the FBI went on a recruiting spree for people in their translation department because they had a backlog of material to get translated. So Sybil was horrified by 9/11, obviously, and at the time, like so many of us, including myself, bought into the story that we were being told and the narrative. Well, I guess, you know, if the FBI needs me and my services, I might as well do it. So she ended up joining the FBI, and she started working in the Washington field office as a translator. And in the course of the year and a half, or what, I don't remember off the top of my head how many months it was that she had security clearance. But in the course of that time, she started to come across all sorts of really disturbing information that was not being properly followed up on by various agents. And in fact, she was eventually actually attempted to be recruited by a Turkish spy operation that had infiltrated the FBI. She was trying to blow the whistle on this at every single stage. She was going to her superiors, she was going above her superiors, she was going behind their backs to try to use some of the government-approved whistleblower devices and institutions that had been set up. And ultimately, she ended up getting nowhere with it, and the Bush administration actually ended up slapping a state secrets privilege on her, which is, at the time, had almost never been used in the history of the United States. It's become, unfortunately, more common in our current era, and it's continued to be used on whistleblowers, but basically it's a hark back to a bygone day and age where supposedly, in the name of state secrets, the government can actually take away your First Amendment rights. So Sybil Edmonds, for example, had suddenly all sorts of information about her becoming classified, even ridiculous things about the date of her birth and things like this, she could not talk about at risk of being thrown in prison. Just a ridiculous state of affairs. So she fought that tooth and nail for years and years and years through all sorts of different systems, through the court systems, through Congress, trying to get congressional hearings, etc. Eventually, basically exhausted all of those possible options and has since set up her own website, boilingfrogspost.com, to try to highlight some of the voices in the alternative media that are shedding light on these types of issues and the police state that's occurring in the United States right now. And I am blessed enough to be working with her. She is just an incredible source of information. She's also so dedicated behind the scenes. She's always, I mean, she must work morning till night, including taking care of her daughter. I don't know how she physically does it. But so I'm working with her as a video producer, and I do a series of reports called The Eye Opener, which comes out every Tuesday. It's a video report, usually about 15 minutes long, exploring a different subject each week. And we're trying to do some hard-hitting analysis. And recently, we've been having a series of conversations about Operation Gladio, which is a fascinating piece of history. It's basically a fully acknowledged false flag terror operation that was set up and puppeteered by NATO for many decades, but and this has been known about for decades now, except most people know about it in its Western European context. Basically, the idea was that NATO set up these stay-behind networks of people that could stay behind, literally, in the event of a, for example, a communist takeover in Western Europe. If the Soviets ever invaded, these networks would stay behind and they would become operational and they would start to do a guerrilla warfare campaign against the communist takeover. But somehow or other, over the course of the decades, that morphed into basically funding and training and arming and equipping these ultra-nationalist right-wing groups that ended up staging terror attacks to blame them on the left side of the political spectrum. And so there are all sorts of terror attacks that have been documented that come directly from this NATO operation. Just an incredible piece of history. But Sibel, in recent weeks on my website, has been adding to this story and has been showing how, in fact, although all of the interest so far in Operation Gladio is concentrated on Western Europe, in fact, Turkey might be one of the keys to Operation Gladio. And examining what's happening today in the Central Asian Caucasus region and the NATO literally working with funding and training terrorists as part of Islamic radical terrorists as part of Operation Gladio Plan B, which is basically the war on terror paradigm. They fund the terrorists who then go out and commit the terror attacks that they then get to use as the boogeymen, which gives them the excuse to go in and invade country after country. So Sibel is breaking all of this down in these hour-long interviews that we're doing every week now for the last few weeks. Just incredible information. And unfortunately, I haven't seen very many people in the alternative media picking up on it, but it's all there on CorbettReport.com, so I implore your listeners to go check it out if they're interested.
That sounds wonderful. Some of those terrorist attacks, and where does 911 fit into the scheme of things?
Well, some of the terror attacks that have been talked about quite a bit in terms of Operation Gladio in the past have been things that, for example, happened in Italy. There was a string of bombings and a terror campaign that was identified as part of a quote-unquote strategy of tension, which is this idea that if you can stir up enough mayhem, damage, carnage within a political paradigm, then you can get people to look at one side or the other of that political situation, and you can play one side off against each other, and you can insert yourself in there. Basically, the old order out of chaos idea. And this was identified and has been talked about in regards to things like the Bologna bombing in the 1980s and things like this, some massive terror attacks that took place in Europe. But now Sibel is connecting this into not only that type of terror, but also now talking about some of the Islamic terror that's going on, and of course how NATO was working quite closely with what we now know of as Al-Qaeda, basically, or the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists, as they would be identified today. We're working quite closely with them, not only in Afghanistan, which, of course, we all know from the 1980s, but also in the 1990s, quite closely in the former Yugoslavia during that conflict, and right up to 9/11. And, of course, 9/11 ties in quite nicely, I suppose you could say, with this entire paradigm, in the sense that it is exactly an extension of that, using the exact same people. And one of those people that is easily identifiable is Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is supposedly now the head of al-Qaeda after Osama bin Laden was supposedly fed to the fishes, and he took over. But Sibel is identifying that Ayman al-Zawahiri was working directly for NATO in this Operation Gladio Plan B, as she calls it, that was operating in the 1990s. And he was literally meeting with high-ranking U.S. officials in Baku, Azerbaijan, in the late 1990s, in high-level meetings that were taking place, where he was basically getting his marching orders. And this is the same Ayman al-Zawahiri, the Osama bin Laden right-hand man, who is the quote-unquote brains of the al-Qaeda network, which ended up, of course, committing the 9/11 attacks, or so we're told. So this all feeds directly into the current war on terror, and all of the terror that we're seeing right now comes from the same group of characters who, behind the scenes, have been in close collusion with the American officials and others in NATO, for example, that have been coordinating this terror as part part of a geopolitical strategy. So this is being laid out point by point, talking about some of the characters behind it. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. But unfortunately, because we haven't been told a lot about this particular aspect of it in the mainstream media, it's difficult for people to wrap their heads around. And some of these names and dates and places and Azerbaijan, I mean, where is that on the map? I mean, some of this is quite overwhelming, so it takes a bit of effort to really wrap your head around it. But once you do, it's just a fascinating story.
Well, it seems like these stories have been going on for thousands of years. I mean, you know, there have been books written about all this stuff since the Roman times and the Egyptian times, and it goes on back further than that. And it seems like there's been some kind of iron hand operating from behind the scenes, you know, long before the United States was ever formed.
Well, at the very least, exactly. And I think at the very least, we can say that there's definitely the science and the techniques of control have been refined over centuries, the course of centuries. And unfortunately, they just keep getting better and better at controlling people and through more and more scientific means. So I think we are reaching a different era in which the type of total control that wouldn't have even been dreamable, it wouldn't even have been imaginable in former periods of time, is now really literally within the grasp of whatever tyrannical dictator wants to use it. And that, to me, is what makes this particular form of tyranny that much scarier than that which has occurred in the past.
Oh, yes. And as you point out, some of your articles, it has a lot to do with the meme control, controlling the written word and how we're influenced subconsciously. And, you know, images, colors, symbols, and so on and so forth. And all the powers that are manifesting here, at least at the obvious levels of the players on the stage, have their own versions of this kind of chessboard that is being used to influence and get us accustomed to the idea that we are pawns on the game. And that we're expendable.
Well, you're right to point out the subconscious aspects of this and other parts like that, because it is very much a psychological matrix of control that's been put into place, and it plays on such primary parts of the human psychology that it actually, I mean, it sounds ridiculous at a certain point, but it truly is. For example, they can divide the political spectrum into the blue team and the red team and get you to cheer for one side or the other, and it just appeals to the most basic parts of human psychology. And unfortunately, as I say, their systems of using and deploying those psychological tactics is only getting more and more refined with each iteration. It's like the Matrix, where they keep rebooting it, and it gets more and more subtle, more and more complex, and therefore more and more people will actually invest their lives in that Matrix. And unfortunately, we're reaching that point where we might be reaching the final iteration of the Matrix, where they're now starting to talk about changing the genome and uploading our consciousness into machines and all of this craziness, which is now being seriously discussed in some circles.
Well, you know, Max Eichen talks about that in some of his videos, and other people are talking about the eugenics programs going on, and we know that the technology exists. The biological and technological research is probably several hundred years away in advance of anything that we're actually shown is going on. So whatever we're seeing, we have to kind of see how they're mirroring this in the movies, because that's about the only place we're going to get accurate information, especially from science fiction films, it seems. But there does seem to be a move afoot to terraform the globe and to weaponize everything and to have us living in a virtual reality that from which we probably would have very little possibility of breaking out.
And it's important for people out there to understand just how complete that media control is, and how subtly it can work, and how much it can manipulate people's perception of the world. And one example that I like to point out in this is Minority Report, which is a movie which, even if people haven't seen, they've probably heard about it through news story after news story over the past several years, as a lot of the technologies they showed and predicted in that movie have started to literally come true. including, for example, advertisements that talk to you. Now we have these billboards that literally beam sound into your ear through this technology that exists now, that they can literally beam the sound directly into your ear from an advertisement and this type of thing. So all of these technologies that seemed really far out there when this movie was released 10 years ago or whatever it is, now are just becoming a part of our day-to-day life. And that isn't by accident. That is actually by design. Few people know, but Steven Spielberg actually flew out a bunch of scientific experts from different fields to California to hold a three-day conference where they worked out what they called the Bible of the Future or something along those lines. And they actually came up with, well, in 50 years and 100 years, what will technology look like? And they actually wrote this entire thesis about the different aspects of life, you know, 50 years from now and what types of technology would exist. And then they basically just tried to portray that in the movie. So incredible amounts of work goes into trying to find the right, you know, level of predictive programming to basically make people used to the types of technology that In the case of some of these things, like the direct technology to talk directly to you, for example, from an advertisement, that was obviously already on the shelves, you know, 10 years ago when this movie was being made. How best to introduce it to people than by putting it in their programming, in their entertainment, because it's just entertainment. And people just turn off their brain and just put it into autopilot and just watch this unfold, these shapes and colors unfold across the screen and enjoy themselves. And they have no idea that they are being programmed to accept and conditioned to accept a reality which is, unfortunately, more often than not, already on the way.
Absolutely. There are some people who would go so far as to say, like people who, like Orwell, were intentionally planting memes for the future, and that movies like The Minority Report and other films that talk about these things, foreshadowing future events, are actually attempts to create them as well.
Well, I think with Orwell, we have to be careful, because I think Orwell was very much on the other side of this. I think this was someone who was very much trying to warn against what he saw coming, and he should know, because he was he worked at the belly of the beast for a long time, including at the BBC as a propaganda broadcaster during the war. So he very much knew what was coming, and so he ended up writing about the Big Brother Corporation. I mean, 1984 isn't as much about the BBC as it was ever about the communist threat or the Soviet threat or whatever people have read about it allegorically in the past. It was very much about the ways that in the name of fighting that enemy, the most incredible social controls can be implemented. And so I think he was warning against that. And some of his writing, for example, Politics in the English Language, and some of the other essays he wrote were just incredibly perceptive. And as I say, unfortunately, although it sounds like science fiction, concepts such as doublethink, etc., unfortunately have proven themselves to be all too real a psychological phenomenon in the years since he wrote that. So we are moving into a 1984 world if we're not there already, but I don't think that was by Orwell's design so much as his warning against what was coming.
Well, that's the way I took it when I read it many, many, many years ago, you know, along with Kafka and Hess and some of the other ones that helped shape my thinking in a more independent way. So yeah, I think you're right about that.
But and then you get interesting figures like Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World, Brave New World Revisited. And he's an interesting character because the Huxley family ties into the heart of the technocratic establishment that he was really writing about in Brave New World. So that, for example, his brother was the founder of UNESCO, and who he wrote about the need to re-legitimize eugenics as something to be taught. And this was the man heading up UNESCO. It's actually in the founding documents of UNESCO, its purpose and philosophy, I believe it's called. Julian Huxley was writing about this. So Aldous Huxley was right in the center of this, and he gave some very interesting speeches, including perhaps his most famous one. It's called The Ultimate Revolution. He gave it at Berkeley in 1962, shortly before his death, where he was talking about the type of scientific dictatorship that is possible these days, and how he believes that that's kind of the more likely scenario for the future of humanity than the 1984 model. It's going to look something more like the Brave New World model, where people are drugged into acquiescence, where they're manipulated at the genome, home from birth, where they are basically placed and slotted into this perfectly technocratic society that's been engineered from the outside. And he says that's already coming into view. And he was talking during this speech, for example, about experiments that he had witnessed going on of basically manipulating people by electrifying different parts of their brain. And you know, that type of experimentation was already going on in the 1960s. And he was talking about it as, oh, you know, oh, this is a terrible thing. People are going to be made to enjoy their own enslavement. But one can debate whether or not he was relishing that prospect secretly or whether he was truly warning about it. But either way, he was definitely at the heart of that scientific establishment and definitely writing about things that are already coming into view right now. And Brave New World is in some ways an even scarier vision of the future than 1984, because whenever there's an outright dictatorial, tyrannical society, humans in the past have always inevitably revolted against it. But when it's presented to them as this wonderful, fluffy, cuddly entertainment society, more and more people will just accept that as not only the way that the world is, but the way it should be. And when people actually start to desire that system of control and enslavement, I think that's the most chilling vision of a future that I can imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I like how David Icke sums it up with problem, reaction, solution. We can reach a point where we're so frustrated with the way things are and the horrible things that are breaking around the world that when somebody comes in and waves their magic wand, it's easy to fall in lockstep with that savior. And there are so many savior programs going on, whether it's religious savior or political savior or spiritual or whatever. You know, we're waiting for a savior to come along and swipe us up and make everything right. And that's how these paradigms tend to work, is by creating horrendous events and then coming in and saying, well, we have a solution for this. And it seems like there's some kind of global event that's being foreshadowed with the resignation of the Pope. That seems to be something that, interestingly, is part of some kind of prophetic paradigm. That there's supposed to be one more Pope. I think it's Peter Petrus or something. I don't have all that information in front of me, but the conspiracy theories will fill that in, and he's the last pope. And so there are lots of rumors flying around about that.
Right. So I believe the prophecy was from Saint Malachi, and it was for Petrus Romanus to be the last pope after Benedict. And interestingly enough, one of the front runners to replace him is now actually by the given name of Peter. So it is lining up with that in an interesting fashion. And I think there's definitely, absolutely, 100%, there's more to the story of the Pope's resignation than simply, oh, he's getting tired. Especially when we remember John Paul at the end of his reign was, basically a puppet. I mean, it was Weekend at Bernie's. I don't want to, not to be disrespectful, but I mean, it was just ridiculous. And so I don't think that we can take this claim that it's due to failing health seriously. I mean, there's something going on here. And I guess we're going to find out one way or another.
Oh, absolutely. This seems to be a time of intense revelations. My friend Cliff High over at the WebBot Project, he predicts all kinds of things, including asteroids, and he had a major hit, literally, with that asteroid that just hit in Russia. And he also predicted some things going on with the Vatican and the Pope. So I imagine he's going to be getting a little more attention to his WebBot reports, because he's refining them to the point where they're becoming pretty accurate.
It's interesting. We'll have to keep our eye on it. But yeah, that meteorite, it makes for some fascinating YouTube footage at any rate. Now I know not to go and look at out the window if I see a meteorite, because it's probably going to explode in my face.
One thing that I've seen a lot going on with is, and this is regarding the economics and the financial transitions, There seem to be rumors from the far right, from one side of the extreme, that indicates that there's some kind of a global financial transition, which is working behind the scenes to change to some kind of new standard, whether it's gold or whatever. And then there are rumors that other countries are buying up gold, and then there's tungsten-plated gold. We don't even know, as you pointed out in one of your articles, what's in Fort Knox, because Goldfinger got him. He already got to the gold reserves, and James Bond didn't catch him in time. So, you know, what's going on with all the gold things? Are countries buying it up, and who holds the real reserves in the world?
Well, actually, that's just what I'm writing about in my most recent Forecaster editorial. So the International Forecaster is coming out tomorrow. It's going to have my editorial talking about the silent gold rush, as I'm calling it, because, you know, 150 years ago, the gold rush was something that was well advertised and brought people from across the Western Hemisphere, basically, out to California to try to pan for gold. And there's gold in them, their hills. And that was, you know, just a cultural phenomenon. But I think we are having a type of gold rush right now, but it's a silent gold rush. It's one that the powers that shouldn't be are trying to keep hidden from the public. And this is most... Sorry?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, sorry. Okay, I thought I heard something. So this is most obviously reflected in the central banks, which are right now buying up gold at a blistering pace, whether you look at China or Russia. Or now we're starting to see this idea of the repatriation of gold. So it started with Venezuela in 2011, asking to get its physical gold back from the banks that it was being held in the U.S. and in the U.K. And now... Actually, after that, we had the domino falling towards the Bundesbank in Germany, which also similarly is repatriating up to almost 700 tons of its gold. And then, and now we have movements in the Netherlands, in Switzerland, even in Azerbaijan to repatriate those countries' gold holdings. So we have more and more central banks that are now insisting on taking physical, actual delivery of their actual real gold instead of entrusting it in the vaults of various places around the world. What on earth is happening? Why are these banks demanding the physical delivery of gold? The only possible reason is because A, there is too many claims to this gold in the various banks that are out there, so that they have to actually ensure that they actually have theirs, that it's not going to be pilfered away when all of a sudden everybody rushes for the exit and finds that there's no gold in the vaults. And B, there's some sort of war type situation shaping up, and they're afraid of what would happen in the event of that kind of conflict. But do we really expect Germany is going to be going to war with the UK or with the US? I mean, this is just ridiculous. Well, unfortunately, in these types of economic collapses, these monetary collapses, systemic monetary collapses, which is what we're facing now with the dollar really being threatened as the dollar reserve, which has been the standard for post-World War international finance, that paradigm is being threatened. And in these times, extremely destabilizing events can take place. So I think we are looking at this type of silent gold rush with these central banks desperately trying to snap up as much physical gold as they can to ensure that they do survive this transition. Meanwhile, we have the talking heads, the pundits, and the central bankers coming out and saying, oh, gold is a bubble. Don't worry about it. We're fine. We're not having a currency war. The G7 just came out with a statement saying, oh, I know we're actually devaluing our currencies, but we're not devaluing our currencies, so don't worry about it. It's ridiculous on its face, but unfortunately, it works for so many people who buy into this propaganda. So that's, I mean, there's definitely on 100% something happening behind the scenes here. And the people who I think are best positioned will be the people who are at the very least diversifying out into other forms of monetary wealth than simply paper. And commodities are a good way to go, and I think precious metals are probably the safest, as they have been for thousands of years.
Well, you know, speaking of precious metals, silver is supposed to be undervalued, and I pay attention to some of Max Kaiser's videos, and it seems that there are companies that have sold contracts many times over, that and they don't have the physical to back it up. So the price of silver and gold have been kept and manipulated theoretically artificially low, and they're kept at a certain rate. If those levers or those chains to the actual price were free-floating, does it seem like those things would just skyrocket?
They would, because as you point out, there are many more claims on the gold and silver than there is gold and silver. And so just by that mechanism alone, that shows that the price is vastly undervalued. And for example, back in 2010, GATA.org, the Gold Antitrust Action Association, they put out an estimate that there was 45 claims for each ounce of gold out there in the market, which would make the price of gold at the time in 2010, it should be something around the $54,000 an ounce level if it was reflecting those at that actual demand. So that was 2 years ago, and so here we are, we're at the 1600 and change level. That's quite a discrepancy. And silver, as amazing as that is, silver has even more of a potential upside in terms of coming into what it should actually be sitting at. So I've heard a lot of different estimates as to what it should go to, but the point I think is that it's vastly undervalued, and not only undervalued against the paper currencies, which as we know are really just not even worth the paper they're printed on, but also silver is undervalued against gold itself. The historic silver to gold ratio of price levels is undervalued itself, so that one would expect that silver would have an incredible upside. And the best part is, I mean, gold can be quite pricey for people to buy. It's to buy an ounce of gold is not a small little purchase you make. It's an investment, but to buy an ounce of silver, to buy a couple of silver coins, that's not a big chunk of change, and most people could afford that if they just cut a little bit out of their monthly expenses. So I for my money, I mean, I can't understand why people wouldn't be trying to at least get some of that. Again, it's just protection against what might be coming. And at the very worst, quote unquote, nothing happens monetarily on the international scale. And at the, you know, 50 years from now, you can retire and have a chunk of precious metal in your pocket that'll still be worth as much as it is now. So I don't see that there's any problem or downside with that. And that's why I'm always suggesting that people at least have a little bit of precious metal in investment, because it certainly can't hurt.
Well, that certainly seems to make a lot of sense to me. So, of course, now we've got bread and circuses going on, so people are distracted, and maybe a $200 dinner at a restaurant or that special seat that at the games, whatever the games are, games du jour of your preference, well, that may be a higher priority. But it seems as if that there's a price for denial and ignorance. And that is missing out at the when the music stops.
That's exactly it. It's an apt analogy. It is a game of musical chairs, and the music is going to stop, and the piper is going to ask to be paid in gold. So I think people have to be ready for that eventuality. And again, it's not all about precious metals. I think we should also be trying to diversify into other ideas, like I think Bitcoin is an idea people should at least be looking into. Alternative currencies, LETS programs, all of these types of things that are happening right now in exchanges, in your local community. That's where we can start to build up an alternative to the current economic system. And that's where we are going to find the salvation, I suppose, at the end of the day. If the system collapses, it's not going to come from government coming down from on high and handing out goodies to people. It's going to come from whatever relationships people are building up right now with their neighbors and their community. And those types of relationships are what can at least theoretically last in the event of a collapse. So I hope people are taking that into account and doing what they can.
Oh, absolutely. I'm with you on that one, because it really is all about relationships and having empathy and feeling and connecting with your friends and neighbors and relatives, because ultimately this is a spiritual stagnation that's going on around the globe. And by refreshing our spiritual aspects and our hearts and our ability to feel, it seems that we will be able to hold together a lot better in smaller communities. So so that was very well said. We're just about out of time, and I wanted to give you a moment to mention again the websites that you are on, and if there's any parting thoughts that you have for the listeners, that would be great.
Absolutely. Well, I'm at CorbettReport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com. And from there, you can find links to all of the various sites that I link to and am associated with. But just as a final parting thought, I just want people to reflect on the fact that we've now been conditioned as a society, really, to be the types of people who will go into public places and spend that time with people out there in the real world, on our smartphones, looking at a little blue shiny screen, engaged in that. And why have we been engineered into this type of society? How have we arrived at this part? How has the basic bonds of human relationships been broken? Well, that's something that has obviously been engineered. So the way to fight it back against that is to put down the smartphone for a second and try to actually talk to a real human being and see how that goes. I think we have to start breaking some of those bonds of conditioning, and that's going to be ultimately what sees us through.
Wow, beautiful. Well said, James. Thank you so very much for being on the show. I could talk to you for hours, and I love your work, and I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
All right. Well, come back again.